Okay, what is your name?
Dustin Phil.
Where do you live?
Ashland, Kansas.
What's your occupation?
Chiropractor.
And how old are you?
I am 33.
Okay, when did you first become aware of the Starbuck fire, hereafter referred to simply as the fire, that occurred on March 6th?
I first came aware of the fire probably when the original Iris alert came out on my cell phone, and then an email, and then a phone call around,
3:40 p.m.
Okay, yeah. Well, they sent something out a little bit earlier than that, that there were fires south of Ashland.
The one for Englewood was like 3:20.
Okay. But I can remember seeing out and looking out in through my office window and seeing a little hazy out there and going outside. And I think Brad McCann and Heather McCann and I sat and I moved over. I saw them looking out too. And it was probably about 11 o'clock in the morning or something around there. But we were all looking off in the distance and I said, oh, that looks a little iffy. And then we kind of went on for the rest of the day. And then, oh, go ahead, I'll go. But the Iris alert came out, and I still had patients scheduled, and they were all from Cold Water and Protection. So I had them go ahead and come in, but then I wasn't going to cancel them because I was like, this can't be real. And so then I finally looked outside, and that's when it was getting a little iffy in town, and I got immediately worried and scared a little bit, so I called them. I was like, listen, I think this might be real, so I'm going to have to cancel you guys, and we'll do it again on Wednesday. It was Monday.
This was Monday.
It was Monday. We'll do it again on Wednesday. Okay. So, yes.
So then, after you canceled your appointments, did you evacuate?
No. My first initial gut was I called Hillary, because my wife's a nurse, at the clinic, and I said, what's going on your guys' end? She said, we're gathering patients, and we're, from our end, and we're canceling patients from the clinic, and we're told to get out. I said, okay, so you and the kids are okay? She said, yes. And then she went home and loaded the dogs and the kids up, and they immediately left. And then after that, as soon as I knew, because she was an able body, and the kids were out, and my parents were gone, first thought was my grandmother in the nursing home, and my Aunt Jackie, who's the activities director. I was like, I know it's got to be chaos down there, because all of us could get in a vehicle and go. Those people were solely relying on somebody else to help them. And so grandma was my first thought, and I immediately got in my vehicle, didn't even go home, went to there, and I saw my Uncle Rick and my Aunt Jackie outside. Aunt Jackie looked a little stressed and panicked, and Uncle Rick, I said, what can I do? How can I help? And Aunt Jackie saw me, and she said, we need you to take a patient. And I was like, okay, whatever. So I loaded up someone other than my grandma, and I asked him, where's my grandma? And Aunt Jackie said, we've got her loaded. She's with us, but you're going to have to take this one, who's going to be a little bit more. So I was the first person out with a patient, and I was told to take them to Cold Water. So I immediately went to Cold Water as fast as I could, dropped that patient off, and I called Aunt Jackie and said, what do I do now? She says, well, we might need you for one more. And when that happened, I said, okay. And then I started driving back in. When I was driving back, that's when the caravans of people were mass exited from Ashland.
Do you have an approximate time?
Okay, so that was 3:40 in the Iris alert. Probably I got there, I probably got to the nursing home around 4 o'clock, 4:15, around in there. And I bet you I made it to Cold Water in 25 minutes. I mean, I wasn't going too incredibly fast, but there was no cop setup. There was no nothing at that point anywhere. And then when I came back, probably about 4:30, 4:45-ish, there was a cop there, and so all those vehicles were coming towards me, and as I was coming back west, they were going east to Cold Water, and people were honking and yelling at me, telling me, no, stop, but Jackie told me that I might need you for one more.
So where's the police setting?
The police were setting at the junction.
Sitka Junction?
Sitka Junction, there, and then so they were, he was telling them, you know, obviously all those people leaving Ashland to go, and then he stopped me, and he said, you can't go that way, and I said, I understand. I'm helping evacuate patients from the nursing home. He said, okay, go, go, go. So then I got there, and there must have been somebody else that came in and got that patient that I was supposed to get there. So after that, our house, or I mean, Hillary was gone, the kids were gone, my parents were gone. And then I got a phone call from my mom and my dad, because at that time, that's when Ashlyn was in intimate danger, and the ranch, Poseidon's Ranch, wasn't. And so Dad took his dogs out there and locked them in one of the sheds. And then I got a phone call from my mom and dad saying, is there any way that you can get out to the ranch? And at that time, it was just hustle and bustle. And I said, okay, to go get the dogs. And then I got a phone call from Hillary because we were getting ready to get married, less than a month away. And Hillary called me and said, honey, I know this might sound silly to you, but I didn't get the wedding dress. I didn't get our suits. I didn't get absolutely anything besides the dogs and the kids and some clothes. So will you please get that stuff? So I did that. I went and gathered all of the much wedding stuff because it was expensive, with the thought and the worry that this could happen. And at that time, I can remember ashes falling all over in town, and Hillary's dress was white, and her heels were stark white. And the dress was covered in plastic, but the shoes weren't. And so those shoes got
a little ash on them.
Yeah, quite a bit of ash on them. And I didn't realize that, but when you're doing that in the hustle and grabbing stuff, and then I started grabbing documents, Social Security stuff, da 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 da. So I gathered all that up. Then Dad's phone call came, and then I said, okay, I'll go out to the ranch. And then I ran into Darren Seacat. Darren Seacat and I were sitting on the corner there looking south, looking north, and just seeing fires in both directions. And then I said, Darren, what do you need? Because Darren's got cattle, and there was six or seven of his horses just about west of town on the highway that you could see they were just running. At that time, you could see the fire. I didn't go out to Poseidon's because I got a phone call from Corey McCann or Kit Walker. I can't remember one of them that said, it's gone. At that point, I was heartbroken and devastated. A, the ranch, the thing that I knew my entire life, was gone. And then I thought, okay, great, Dad's dogs are gone. But the one building that stayed up, the only one erected building out of Poseidon's, that's the one Dad put him in. But, you know, Dave lost all of his dogs in the dog run, and 30-some plus hunting dogs and all that stuff, plus, you know, everything else that's already known, you know, the cattle and whatnot.
Right.
But that was a very emotional time. So Darren and I bypassed the highway patrolman because he told us couldn't go, and Darren said, no, I'm going. So Darren blocked his truck off on one side of the highway, and I blocked my truck, and then I went and ran up in the gate and opened it as fast as I could so the horse didn't run towards the fire. And at that point, that was when the fire was just crossing the road, and the horses
on the west
ran.
Side of town?
Yes, on the west side of town. So then the horses came running into the new hospital build was going on. And Darren and I went back to his place, and we just started staring. And that point was where I really thought, because, I mean, there was less than, I mean, we were the only ones in town. I mean, there was, I mean, 15, 20 men that I could run into that during that day. So Hillary was always terribly worried, too, for me. That I tried to, after all that got done, I said, okay, I need to be with my family. Well, I tried going west at that, or going back east at that point. They said, no, you can't go that way. So then I tried going back west. The guy said, no, you can't go that way. And then he said, well, you can go south at this point. And at that point in my mind, I said, I'm not going south if I can't be with my family and everyone else, and then be removed me from Ashland, because if there was anything that I could do here, I could at least do something. I'm an able-bodied, capable man. And so when we sat there and I asked Darren, what are you going to do? He said, well, we're probably going to go cut barbed wire down. So that's what we went out and did, is because, you know, there were people everywhere. People were else doing all other stuff. But you could see areas that there was nobody there, but you could see the cattle in there. And so at that point, we just knew, just cut and pray. And it ended up working out for quite a bit of them along that River Road area. And some of Darren's stuff, and other people's that I didn't even know.
How far south did you go on the River Road?
We went as far as, let's see, probably 5 or 6 miles because we originally went to Darren's stuff and did his stuff first with some land he rented. I couldn't tell you who it was, what land he rents. But then at that point, I started live feeding it because my phone was blowing up nonstop and I couldn't answer at all. And it's the only reason why I did that, because I wanted to make sure, because there was rumors flying that Ashland was on fire, like the town was on fire.
Right.
And I wanted to stop that because I didn't want people to be coming in. But at the same time, I said, Ashland's not on fire. But at that point, it didn't look good in my eyes. I really, really thought that this is real. I really, really thought the new hospital build was going. There was no doubts in my mind when I saw that coming in the way it did. And then, 7:30, 8 o'clock, it's like the wind switched directions. And you could see the smoke. It was no longer just coming into town. The smoke just started blowing due south. So a hospital build, and probably 150 yards from that to the west of it, a rock's throw from it, where I was at, it just burnt around it, and there was nothing there besides Mr. Harden's plowing and the golf course. I think that saved that part. But I saw with my own eyes that the wind switched directions, and it truly, I think, saved at least that part of town.
Did you feel the temperature drop?
Uh-huh, yeah.
All happened about the same time?
Yeah. It was, and Darren and I, like I said, I mean, that was the most emotional time for me, because I really thought that, A, that the new hospital bill was going, and or the town was going. Because, the worry in my mind was so bad that I ran back to my house, and I turned on my sprinkler system. That was, March 6th. And so I turned my sprinkler system on, which was still freezing, because we had a freeze, So I turned it on, and I just watered all of my stuff, and I left them on for 24 hours. And just droughted everything. But
did you come home to ice?
Did I come home to ice?
Uh-huh. Did your lawn freeze up with the temperature change?
No. It didn't cool down that much. And I can remember, I didn't sleep for that 36 hours. There was no way I could sleep that night in town in Erie. Well, and that led into another thing. So I just kind of cruised town. Just to make sure, because I'm not saying that there would have been vandalism or what, but I didn't know who was still in town, who wasn't in town, because it was an eerie feeling.
So did you go, out to the golf course or down the airport?
I went to the hospital.
Went to the hospital?
I went to the hospital and the nursing home.
What about
the east side? I could hear the alarms going off. And I was hoping that everything was locked down from that point. And so I didn't think that I could get in, but obviously I got in through the nursing home, because you can get in through there. And I was like, okay, I don't think I can get into the hospital because the door's locked. Well, at that time, it was just a mad exodus. We got the patients out, and we did the things that we needed to do. The med rooms were locked down, both where their drugs were at. But if you truly wanted to vandalize it, it could have happened. But that was probably the eeriest thing to me. I was walking into that hospital nursing home.
And nobody there.
And nobody there, and every siren. Everything, oxygen stuff, all that stuff just going beep, 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 and hearing radio dispatch, and so eerie. And I'm not scared that much, but the eerie feeling that it took me to go through that all those hallways just to double check it in my mind, and then go from the nursing home through the little window gate or through the
yeah,
and into the hospital, and sit in there, and I sat in there for a good hour and a half until I dispatched, or I called John Ketron and said, hey, listen, I don't know. And he said, well, that's a good idea. I said, they dispatched somebody from Meade to come down and kind of patrol Ashland, and that's what they were doing. And so until they arrived, and I locked up what I could from the inside, and so I stuck in there, and that was 2 to 3:30 in the morning that I just sat in there, and then I went back out with Darren Seacat till 4, 5, 6 in the morning.
Did you ever go up to the firehouse?
I went by the EMS barn and went there for a little bit and talked to John Ketron for a little bit, and he was slightly irritated that I was Facebook Living it, and I explained to him from my end why I did what I did. I wasn't saying that, hey, it's clear to come into Ashland. But during that Facebook Live feed, a news station called me, a Wichita member called me, and said, this is such and such from, I think it was KWCH or K, I can't remember, one of the two, and said, would you do a live interview, because we can't get any reporters or anything in there. And I was eerie about it, because I didn't stay in Ashland or do that stuff for any acclamations or awards or and I was just, I love Ashland, and my wife even knows that I bleed Ashland. I'll do anything I can for Ashland. And that's what I kind of told them when they interviewed me. I was just like, it's not good. I said, but our town's not burning. I said, but it's literally a fiery glow all the way around. I said, there's nothing you can see in the town. It's smoky and it's like one massive campfire. I said, I can't only imagine waking up in the morning of what this is going to be like. I said, because everything I've known my entire life is around it. Is gone, and I don't know to what capacity, how much is gone.
So when you mainly stayed on the west side at Darren's?
No, I deal? Then went over to the highway onto the east side where the rest stop area is, because that was the closest point to me where I think it got into the city limits, because I was worried about my Aunt Frances, Frances mm-hmm. Baker, because
yeah.
she's a stubborn.
Did she evacuate?
She evacuated, and that's a strange thing. So I was over there, and when I was kind of recording, because I wanted to document it all. At that point, I really thought the cemetery was up in flames, the entire cemetery. However, it was just that little section. When I was over there pointing over there, my Aunt Frances pulls up behind me, and I didn't know who it was, and she said, "What are you doing, recording my house burning?" And I went, "Oh, there you are." I was worried. She goes, "Yes, Frank Finley and Keith Baker got her out of there, forced her to go out of there."
Yeah.
But her house, obviously, it didn't burn. But from that angle and where I was at, being completely dark and seeing fire everywhere, I was 100% sure that that was gone. And it wasn't.
Good time. So what about Tuesday? You didn't sleep all night Monday?
No. Tuesday, let's see, when did people finally start coming to town?
It said 8:30.
Yes. So Dad and Mom started coming to town. Well, Hillary, she had anxiety, and she was a little just emotional. And so she was a nurse in Coldwater forever. And so she was helping there because she was a nurse here. So she knew all the patients, and she was just doing what she could because she also knew the facility at Coldwater. So she was helping man all of that. And then finally she got exhausted around 3 or 4 in the morning. But it was so hectic down at the gymnasium where everyone was gathering with dogs and animals and people. And it was just, and I had a friend there that was a patient of mine. I called her and I said, "Hey, can," she had a house she had up for sale. I said, "Can Hillary and the kids come there?" She said, 100%. So she gave me the combo to the code and I sent Hillary there. So they were able to get some sleep that night because it was chaos there. But then Tuesday, Dad finally came home, and my dad had just gotten 2-3 weeks before that, had just gotten ran over by a bull, or a cow, pregnant, and it broke 6 ribs, and he had some heart problems afterwards and whatnot, and so he hadn't been back to work at all, because he wasn't able to. Well, my dad's worked for Dover Zidon for 33, 34 years,
mm-hmm.
and there was no way in hell that you were going to keep my dad away. Even though my dad didn't own anything out there, my dad knows that place inside and out. And any animal he treats as his own, even those dogs, you know, Dave's bird dogs, those are life his. He takes care of them and he loves them as his own.
Yep.
But he had to go, you know, he had to go out there and do whatever he could. He could barely even breathe, let alone. So I went with Dad and I said, "You know what, I'll help you." I said, "I don't think you need to be going out here, but I'll help you." So I opened the gates and we tracked down, we were trying to locate Rosiden's cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat east of town on the Perry, the Perry ground, kind of but by Mount Jesus and all that area. Right next to the Jim Miller's stuff, which complete devastation. And all of that was devastating, but there was some wheat pasture there.
Did you see any dead cattle?
Oh.
Did you have to help shoot cattle, or did you?
Yes. Well, Mom and Dad went out for a little bit that day. Mom helped him. Matter of fact, that was another time. Mom and Dad went out and started shooting, or Dad started shooting. and then you'd see a calf that was completely okay, or their hooves were just a little burnt, or their skin or their fur was a little bit burnt, hair, and then we'd load them up and tie their legs, and so mom and them did that, and I showed up right afterwards out there, and then I helped unload three of those calves off of the back of dad's truck that my dad couldn't. And so I unloaded those and I took them into the one remaining shed that was standing, the old horse shed, and we took them in there. And I promise you, we laid those down, we undid them, and we put some water in there for us. Obviously, we didn't have time to bucket feed. And when I came back there at 7 o'clock that night, those calves were still laying in the same position. I was pretty sure they weren't going to make it. And then we got two bottle feedings in them, and after the second bottle feeding, I promise you, it was like a miracle. Those guys just get up and they're playing each other, butting each other's head, and that was kind of uplifting, because you know, like we ended up saving seven of those.
So, what was your first thoughts when you drove out there, and saw the change from what you were used to seeing when you went out there?
Poseidon's.
Mm-hmm.
That was.
What was that like for you? Because,
Dave and Carol like second family to us, and then my dad doesn't cry at all, and dad started welting up, and then you know it was completely obviously just ashes, and all you can see is everything just smoldering and coming back out, and that was tough.
I mean, what did it smell like?
A campfire, a massive campfire and smoke that you can't get away from. I mean, that's what everything smelled like for days and days and days and days on end.
Yep.
But that was tough. And then I, you know, Carol Poseidon evacuated. She made it to Winoka, or to Alba, mm-hmm. And then she came back. I don't know, Thursday, Wednesday, she came back, because I don't think she was ready for the magnitude. And it was a very personal, intimate moment, so I won't share. But being there when Carol got home and seeing it was probably tougher than anything. That was unbelievable and just
hard to do.
Yeah.
So did you personally lose anything in the fire?
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any physical loss? I mean, like hurt yourself?
No, but I have had recurrent sinus infections and allergies that I've never had in my life since the fire.
From all the smoke and stuff?
And it's the only thing it can be, an environmental change and new pollens or something coming up. But, yeah, I deal with that and my dog. My dog does, too. My dog's getting treated for allergies now.
So when did you reopen your business after the fire?
I took off for a week, and I tried going back to work. I didn't know. I work in Alvis on Tuesdays and Thursdays and live in Ashland, or work in Ashland Monday, Wednesday, Friday. I immediately was not going to work on Tuesday to Alva. Called in there, and then Wednesday, obviously, I as the first time in my life that I never even thought, it wasn't even a thought process to go into my office, whether there was patients scheduled or not. I just didn't even think. Thursday, I ended up going to Alva, but I stayed there for like, no, I didn't go to Alva. I didn't work that entire week. I tried going back to work that Friday, and it was absolutely pointless from my mental mindset, thinking, there's nothing, I don't know why I'm in here. I don't, if someone's back hurting or, you know, whatever, there's so much more things I can be doing.
Yep.
And I didn't have the equipment, you know, or the money or whatever, but I do know Ashland very well, and I know everybody. And so the one remaining building at Poseidon's, that's what I did that entire Friday, is I was out there because everyone else was riding four-wheelers and killing and dragging deads and whatnot. And so I just went into the horse barn because it's full of ash. Those bucket calves were in there. And it was just – the shop needed cleaned out anyways. And at that point, it was the only standing building left, so I thought, I need to clean this out. So I stuck in there for like 12 hours and cleaned that out. And so for Poseidon's, it helped because that kind of made them their only one headquarter and closed building where they could put stuff. But, you know, there was no, they didn't have a lot. They didn't have anything to put anywhere. But if, you know, supplies and donations started coming in from there, that's where we started storing it there.
So did they start getting a lot of donations that week? Did most of it start the next week?
Yeah, started the next week. Because then that's where I played a role, and that was doing... I went back to work that next week, and it was slow, though. I mean, I was incredibly slow, and I was worried. I mean, there was a lot of worry on my mind from a lot of different angles. Being on the hospital board, the tax base, evaluation, and all these things that were swirling in my mind that probably most people aren't probably thinking about. And the economical impact that this did to our community. I mean, this is worse than a tornado. This is worse than anything that could have happened to our agricultural-based place, and still to see the effects going further. But that was my thought. It's like, gosh, this is... Nay, not knowing that the people were going to give as much as they did and came and all that stuff, which kind of lifted my spirit, but still, from a business standpoint of mine, it was a definite struggle. You know, like I said, it was like a trickle-down effect. It affected everybody.
Right. So did you help with when the volunteers came that week? Mm-hmm. Did you help feed people? Or
no, I went down to the church camp and for 2 weekends in a row. And since I knew, like, the land and the outside, you know, I knew where the Betcherts are at, the gardeners are at, and mm-hmm. the Riches, or wherever they wanted to dispatch hay or donations or whatever to, I'd basically take them, follow me, and these semis would follow me, and then we'd go and we'd just unload bale after bale after bale after bale after bale. I didn't build any fence, but I unloaded a crap ton of hay for 2 weekends in a row. One with a group of Ohio guys and one with a group of Michigan guys. Yeah. And now I'm friends with those guys on Facebook. And
did you do any fencing materials? Unloaded any
of
that?
Oh, yeah. I unloaded everything under the sun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I did for a while there. And then, then we had our wedding. So, and our wedding got completely put on the back burner, no pun intended, but I mean, we planned on for those 3 weeks before our wedding to get a lot of the
last minute stuff done.
And that last minute stuff truly became last minute, and I didn't think it'd come together, but it came together. But that was the first big event post fire that had, you know, had happened. And
did you have a lot of people at your wedding?
Yes, but then we also had a lot of people that probably would have come locally, or, you know, that didn't come because they were doing other stuff, which was completely understandable.
Did you take some time off? So were you gone for a while after your wedding?
Yes, we went on our honeymoon for 8 days.
Okay, and then when you came back, how was Ashland when you came back?
It was amazing to be removed. It was not amazing. It was relieving to be removed during that time, just from the smoke, the environment standpoint, because it was depressing just seeing around. And so then we went to this beautiful exotic place in Mexico, Riviera Maya. And then coming back, you know, we were for sure, like, the smell of smoke and that stuff would be gone and all that. No, it mm-hmm. still smelled. If you remove yourself from a smell or you know something for so long and then you come back, no, it was still ashy,
still
it was still smoky, it was still in our house. But, yeah.
So, like, when you go to Alva and you go down towards Sitka and you come back on the road mm-hmm. 160 that comes back into Ashland, what are your thoughts about what's there or not there anymore?
Yeah.
The first time you saw that, what did you think?
Yeah. I mean, all those outcrop buildings that you know, just like Wool and Sitka, when you see that big picture of the co-op and all that blaze kind of heading towards your brother's,
right
in their house. You know, at that time, I was for sure Jewel Hazen's and Reager's houses were gone. And they weren't. And even Sitka, old Sitka itself, wasn't gone. So, I mean, those structures are there, but then you kind of turn the corner and you come. But I didn't go down towards, like, Wilson's and Cohen's and all of them. And I knew immediately that they were, but that was probably tougher for me because, A, I personally know. I know the Wilson's very well. And that was the hardest, obviously, to me was Bo Zeiden's. But, you know, what was there, 35, however many homes that were lost, I'm not sure. But of those X amount of houses, I homes, I think I knew 95% of them personally, on a personal note. Yeah. And that's what, you know.
Yeah. That. So have you ever had any dealings to do with wildfires before? Does your family have a history of wildfires?
No, but I was driving home the day of Alva. I was driving home when the Anderson Creek fire mm-hmm. started. I was at point A. There was a fire brewing underneath the bridge in between, well, like kind of right before you get to Camp Houston.
Yeah.
And there was two or three vehicles stopped there. But I kind of stopped and I said, you need some help? I said, oh, the fire trucks are on their way, you know, and then the rest of that story.
Yeah.
And that was unbelievable to me to know that I saw that at point A. And could have I done anything? I don't know, maybe. But if not, I don't know. But underneath there was a crap ton of tumbleweeds.
Oh.
And I think, to me, from when I looked and stopped, saw fire, then suddenly the wind must have switched direction, something, and the oxygen got in there, and then that just became and it just
went.
It just went. And then I went to Kansas City, 14, 15 days later, and I go the Medicine Lodge route, so cold water Medicine Lodge, and then driving through that, I was like, oh my goodness, that started in Alva.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, and knowing the land and knowing the amount of miles that covered, and then talking about that, and then do comparative speaking to ours. And ours is twice, almost three times the size of it.
Yeah.
And that's unbelievable to me.
Yeah, in one county.
In one county.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what were some of the people or agencies that proved most helpful during the fire or after the fire? And maybe not agencies, but departments or people that...
Locally?
Anywhere.
Well, the firemen have to have the most... I mean they're working with... In the terms of the mass of how big that fire was to what they have, I mean, they were working with nothing. I mean, in big scheme of things, even those guys from Colorado that came down with the big old trucks, they said they'd never seen anything that magnitude. And, you know, it's a different environment fighting with those big canyons instead of, you know, massive mountains and trees. It's the unique challenges in itself. So, hey, I think the firemen of all across the board have to have the most... deserving, and then just I think our community as a whole, and then over, you know, the power of social media and Facebook, because it wasn't anyone else but us local people that started here, and then just share after share after share. My video, I'd have to go back and look, but at one time, I think it had over. At one time, within 2 days, it had over 49,000 views and shares of people watching that. And that went on for weeks to months that. And the comments of people and seeing and tracking them and seeing some as far as Europe. And I don't know if that's because we've had quite a few exchange students.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there were some people from there that I didn't even know. And to me, that was just amazing. That was incredible. And so I think that in itself was an organization and or a community and Facebook that gave us at least gave us some attention to allow us to get some of the needed help that we need, because we couldn't do it by ourselves. I mean, there's still new people that are in our town that have come here because of the fires, and they haven't left.
Right. That's true.
Some families have moved here.
So what is your most vivid memory of the fire?
Probably the first time, you know, the emotions hit me was looking north towards Bozidens, but a little bit, you know, like if you're looking towards Mineola, sitting on the west end of town and looking northwest and seeing the amount of smoke and the massive flames from probably 20, 30 miles out is what I'd have to guesstimate, and thinking... Bozidens is right there. There's no way.
What color was the smoke?
Black. Gray as could be. I mean, black and gray, and then you'd see the flame fly up, and then a flame go away. Flame fly up. And, you know, videos do one thing, but your actual eyes out there and seeing it is another thing. But that's by far my most. That, and then driving out to those islands and seeing absolutely nothing.
So can you perceive anything positive that has come from this fire?
My faith in humanity, my faith in people that I didn't know, complete strangers, that makes me know that me moving back to Ashland wasn't, there's other Ashlands out there, as in there's other people that have morals and integrity and an honest and are willing to still give their shirt off their back or sacrifice or do whatever, because I only thought that was, you know, maybe I'm biased, but that was instilled in me, you know, from my parents, but also from the community. Back in the day when I was, you know, younger, I mean, the community raised you. It takes, you know, it takes a village to raise a child. Mm-hmm. And that truly is. Never in a million years did I ever think I'd come back to Ashland, Kansas when I left. And then I was gone for 11, going to school and whatnot. And when I got back, it was like, so yeah, that would be it, is restoring my faith in people because of the timing, the political spectacle that we've been having, and it's been nothing but division left and right. And it's just, it was overwhelming, and it's been, you know, it's just nothing but hate. And some of these people from Michigan to Ohio to, you know, wherever have come to our aid. And I couldn't imagine. I sit there, and I was just before I came in here, I was watching the video of the floods in Houston. You know, that's not that far away from us. And I'm sitting there thinking, could I go down there? If I go down there, what could I do? Could I be a resource, or do they need, you know, something more monetary or financially, or, you know, what? Because I never in a million years would have thought of doing. I don't know if I could afford to go away for 7 to 8 days like some of those people did. And they probably couldn't afford it either, but they did it anyways.
Yeah.
And so it made me go, you know what? Someone's in help, and if you can help, I'm going to help, you know?
So besides the truck drivers and the people that brought the hay, did you get to visit with some of the volunteers that came and built fence or tore out fence or?
Well, yeah, because I took some of them around. Like when I'd dispatch and I'd go take them around, I'd take a group of kids with me from wherever they would come from. And I took a group of kids from, what is that town? Somewhere up northeast Kansas. I can't even remember the town's name because I'd never heard of it. And I think it's a little bit bigger than Ashland. But it was not a 4-H, an FFA. Group of kids that came down, and they said that they just really wanted to come down and see what they could do. And so they got stuck with me, and I said, listen, you come with me, it's not going to be fun work. I said, none of this is fun work. I said, but it's going to be better than building fence, because building fence is dusty, smoky, ashy, wind's blowing nonstop. The wind's still going to be blowing nonstop where we're at, but you're going to have a little bit breaks out of the
So what did you have them do?
We unloaded truck after truck after truck after truck of small bales.
So what is their perception of the fire? Of, I mean, once they got here, did they have
they didn't even know Ashland existed. You know, I mean, we're so far kind of removed from everyone. And at the same time, they could still, and some of them made comments of, man, look at those red hills, or, you know, because they don't have that there. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the dark contrast of the black. And then at that time, there's still cattle all over, dead, upright.
Right. Yeah.
And looking at them, and, you know, that's a somber. And we'd go through to go all the way up to into Gardner's, where they took a massive hit, and you just saw it everywhere. And they.
Do you see a lot of wildlife that was dead?
No, I didn't see a lot of wildlife, but I just saw massive amounts of cattle, lots of cattle.
So, had by the time they left, had their ideas of what fire could do changed from when they first got here?
I think very evidently that they for sure. Because they were 14, 15, 16-year-olds that I dealt with. And then the older guys, the truck drivers from Ohio, they heard Mark Gardner's, they saw Mark Gardner's video of an old, a cowboy, rough and tough guy, and sitting there and talking about, a state basketball game.
Right.
Yeah, was coming up, and that was emotional as a town in itself, and we were still going to play in it and whatnot. And then the interview in Mark, and then the Ashland Blue Jay fight song. Have you seen that video?
I think I've seen part of it.
At that time, and even now, I watched that today. Mark Gardner bawling and crying in it, and then them switching over to the Ashland fight song, which I don't even know how the news station got it, which was incredible, and transitioned over into it to the basketball game and whatnot and the camaraderie. It was absolutely, they saw that video, and that's what made them think, gosh, we got to get down there. We got to help them. Yeah. This is terrible.
So what can you do or have you done to prepare for another emergency, whether it be a fire or a tornado or disaster of some type?
I've thought over and over again, how can we get around the problem with this mass cattle devastation? I don't have the answer, but there has to be some answer. Do we grid it off or something, or make, I don't know, safe zones? Or I've been trying to think, because that was the biggest part is the cattle and the fence.
Yep.
Or how do we invent something where the fence can survive, or all of that stuff. I mean, that those are things, but what have I done? I have a very amazing smoke detector and CO2 system now that I upgraded that alerts my phone and whatnot, which I got.
So what about saving treasures that you have at your house?
A lot. Well, we also do have, that's the thing is, we've also got a safety deposit box, which I was never going to have, but I can't imagine of just replacing one social security number or one birth certificate or something. It's a hassle and such a struggle. But then try to do it without the evidence or without the documents that they need. So now we have all of that in one place, safety deposit box, that is safe.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's something, yeah.
Yep. So what about the community? Are there some things they could do different or better?
I would say we were thankful. I mean, I wouldn't say that we were thankful that it happened here, but what if it happened in, what if the epicenter was more like Coldwater or Protection or Fowler that didn't have something such as a church camp like we had? Something where could sleep 100 to 150 people easily and entertain and feed and shower and bathe. I mean, we were lucky that we had that church camp. The church camp didn't burn down, and it was able for us to do those things. So I think that was very good from a coordinating standpoint. But the mass amount of people that volunteered just locally that weren't affected by losing them anything, but helping to keep everything organized. And I thought, the vet clinic started it, they handed it over. I thought all of that was, to me, was amazing.
Did you ever go eat at the school?
I didn't eat at the school, but I helped a little bit preparing meals down at the church camp.
And did you help at the church when they did meals at the church?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, at our church.
Yeah.
Yeah, at First Christian Church, yes. Yes. So, yeah, I know other things is what all the small towns face, or, we need better access to better fire trucks, to to that kind of stuff. I mean, it shows you that we need that. At one time, I can remember someone, I think it was Nick Johnson, who's an EMT, said one time there were 35 confirmed fires around, and at that time there was only 11 fire trucks that were in the area.
Mm-hmm.
Do the math. It's a losing battle. I mean, and so I don't know. I encourage still a lot to this day. People need to have access to that IRS alert. The only reason I got on and signed up for that is I went to the hospital fair, the health fair, and Millie had a booth set up, and she told me what it was about, and I said, "Oh yeah, that's great." Some people didn't have that. Myrna Cohen didn't have it. They had no idea. They just saw it, and her husband said it's fine. And she got to looking because she was a little bit more worried, and she's looking, and she said, "Honey, it's not fine." And they got out. You know, her story is unbelievable. Have you heard her story?
Not yet.
Oof. That hers is pretty unbelievable. You know, and they lost everything. Their beautiful cars, and, you know, some of their stuff, all their farm equipment, all, I mean.
Yep.
And had they known, been on the alert, I think that would have been a different story for them. They could have at least got some more stuff out. They still would have lost everything, but they didn't think they were anywhere near harm's way.
Well, yeah, the fire was supposedly southwest of Inglewood.
Yeah.
It's like, when did you first hear about the fire up north?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And well, I saw it, and that's why I was confused. I was like, okay, is that fire that moved all the way that way and now the wind switching directions? No, that was another fire that started. And then that fire was the one that we were worried about for town. But then that fire north is the one that became intimate danger to us, to the town.
Yep.
And so that was,
So do you have any other thoughts about this experience that you'd like to share or things that you'd like to add?
You know, there's two events that I remember vividly. You know, like they say, where were you when JFK, you know, got shot? And, you know, people can remember that. My mom could tell me back where she was. You know, the events that happened in my life that I can tell you were 9/11. I can tell you exactly where I was at, what I was doing, what I was wearing. You know, and that vividness and how your mind recalls that moment. And same as March 6th. I can tell you every single day. I can tell you what was weird is I got my son, Caleb, a little Alexa, Amazon little thing where you can speak to it and it tells you whatever you want. So I got that for him and it was sitting on the counter. And that morning on March 6th, I said to it, just asked it. And we just set it up 2 or 3 days ago and I'd never asked it. I just saw it and I said, "Alexa, what's the weather supposed to be like today?" And she went back and said, "The weather is a high chance of fires in your area. Be cautious, blah, 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 something other." And gave, like, you know, a scripted reading of it. And I remember that and I went, huh, that's weird. I swear that happened. And then that happened.
Yeah.
And that day from there on else, you know, that day will live in my mind for the rest of my life. Until the day I die. And I told that, you know, fourth grade class. I gave an interview because Heidi Hazen asked me to give an interview. Hold on 1 second. Hello? Hey, I'm at that. I'm here, hon.
Oh, wasn't it?
Uh-uh.
You already did it?
Yeah. I'm down here right now. She could probably interview you from your side. Have you had any nurses?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. No, I've got it taken care of. I'm getting ready to go down to the men's. I'm still in it, hon. Okay. Bye. But, yeah, when I interviewed that fourth grade class and told them that, you know, guys, this is huge. This is something you're going to remember for the rest of your life. And, of course, they had David and Carol Bozidon coming in after me. And I say, and they were being a little bit disrespectful there, for, you know, just kids being kids. And I said, I'm going to tell you guys right now that these next people that come in here, listen to every single word that they say because, you know, they've lost everything. Everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dave, you know, when Dave said, it took me 60 years to build what I got and it took me 30 seconds to lose everything.
It's true.
In a blink of an eye.
Yeah.
It was unreal.
So any other thoughts?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much for
You're
sharing
welcome.
Your experiences
I'm
with
looking
us.
Looking forward to you guys as we'll see what you put together.
Yep. Me too.
Okay. All right.